Welcome to the year-end edition of the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. Today we're going to take a look back at the year of crime and legal affairs in 2015. North Texas featured a McKinney pool party, an absentee district attorney, a Dennis love triangle, an Iraqi man killed in his first snowfall, a Garland terrorist plot, a White Rock Creek Trail runner's death, a police headquarters attack, a fight over the police chief's career, and much, much more. In the studio, we'll have a few Dallas Morning News reporters in to recount their biggest stories of the year, and we'll get started now with Naomi Martin in the studio. Naomi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tristan.
Naomi, looking back at 2015, we covered a lot of big stories, but what do you think to you stood out?
So in August, I got to go on a long trip with my colleague Seema Yasmin on a reporting trip to St. Louis to look at why a woman had died after getting her butt enlarged on the black market through these silicone butt injections, allegedly by a Dallas woman. And I had covered two of these similar deaths before, one in Dallas, one in New Orleans. And it always seemed so strange to me that women would risk their lives to have a larger butt. I know we all as women have body image issues and we want to look, you know, like the models in the magazine or Kim Kardashian nowadays or whoever the latest person is. But it just seemed so unnatural and just kind of, I was just kind of judgmental of these women. Like, why would they, you know, knowingly risk their lives for this? And so Seema and I got there and we hung out with these strippers. We went to the strip club where the woman who had died had worked. And we started talking to them and we sort of saw their world and how much butts really do matter in that world, you know, that they make more money when they have a larger butt, but also just like the image that they have of what they're supposed to look like. And we ended up at a Waffle House at 6 a.m. with these two strippers and we were talking, you know, and Seema and I have such different backgrounds. I'm from Boston. She's from London. And we were talking to these two women who are from the Midwest. And it was just like we all kind of had this common experience of wanting to fit this ideal image, even though Seema and I aren't, you know, we get paid the same regardless of what we look like. It was just sort of eye-opening to be like, wow, you know, we all feel this pressure. And then it kind of made sense to me of why they act on this pressure. I don't necessarily agree with it. I don't think, you know, necessarily it's the best idea. But you can see why they would make that choice because it just sort of, in their world, their money depends on it. They have a lot of Instagram is a big part of their life with their followers and
right.
their likes.
I remember you showing me some of these Instagram photos where they were making it look like this was naturally achieved, that this look was by doing squats.
Yeah, some of these women who get the butt injections will post videos of them doing squats and their butts are huge. And so a lot of people are probably watching those videos thinking like, I can do that too. But it is a big part of their image. And so that sort of hit home to me was just that, you know, I went there kind of being a little bit judgmental and I sort of left feeling like it makes more sense now. And the other part of it was they really don't understand how risky it is, I think, because it's so common. Like the dancers said that about half the women there have had these butt injections. They never knew of anyone having any complications before the woman died. So to them, it didn't seem that risky. And I think that was kind of another enlightening thing of that trip.
It's definitely a different world than the one that, you know, you or I know. It ended up being another Dallas woman was charged for this, correct?
Yes. And actually, so we initially had heard that it would be the woman that they were looking at the woman who was charged in Dallas in the death in February in Deep Ellum here. But it turns out that the police actually charged another woman who is not that same woman. And they sort of said that Dallas seems to be like an epicenter of butt injections, sort of like Atlanta is. And Dallas and Atlanta seem to be sort of the two cities where people who want butt injections can find them easily.
All right. Well, Naomi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Our next reporter in the studio is Nahid Rajwani. Nahid, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tristan.
Nahid, you covered a incident in Ellis County this year that we've talked about on the podcast before, but could you talk a little bit about what happened there?
Sure. So this incident is from January of this year, and basically what the allegations were that there were five firemen at an Ellis County fire station. This was a volunteer department who allegedly attacked a 20-year-old recruit and sexually assaulted him using a sausage. And the allegation was that one of the five firemen's girlfriends was the one who recorded the attack and circulated it amongst other people in the town. And in April, these arrests happened. These six people were arrested in addition to the fire chiefs and the assistant fire chief of the department.
So what did they say that the assistant fire chief and the fire chief did?
The allegation, prosecutors say that the chiefs were the ones who basically knew about the attack but tried to cover it up by instructing the firemen that were involved, including the victim, to not talk about it publicly and to delete the video.
Obviously shocking allegations. You talked to the victim of this attack. What was that like for you?
Sure. So it's important to know that usually victims of sexual assault don't want to be identified publicly. And this case was interesting because this victim, Jason Waldeck, said, yes, I want to, my name to be out there. I want to, people to know who I am and to know what happened to me. So in October, he created a GoFundMe account. And basically in it, he talked about how not only what he alleges happened to him, but also what he wants to do next and how it's these allegations have shaped him as a person. So for he said, quote, coming forward was the hardest and most embarrassing thing to do, but I'll be okay in the long run. I just want to get back to the path that they took me off of. And he signed it John Doe number 72. And for many months, we didn't even know his name. We didn't know who he was. So it was really interesting and powerful almost that he signed this GoFundMe account with the name that he is that's used for him in court records.
So what when you actually first met him, what was his demeanor and did he was he comfortable opening up to you about this?
Yes, he was very comfortable. There are a lot of questions that we had, you know, what in your mind happened that night and also how have the allegations changed you? And he's very open from throughout all of that. And you can tell that it's very tough for him to talk about certain allegations and what he says happened to him. But despite all that, he, you know, said that he is trying to move on, move past what happened to him. And he lives in the rural parts of Ellis County. So you can imagine lots of acres of land with his family. And his mom was in the living room and he played the video that he says he's seen dozens of times of that incident. And his mom was just like stepped out of the room and said, I can't listen to this. I can't watch this. So it's really interesting watching him as a young aspiring fireman talk about these allegations that, you know, quote unquote, could be a question of his manlihood in a way, especially when when you're talking about sexual assault. And it's really hard for men to come out and talk about these issues that they face as well.
What comes next for him and for the case?
So for him, he wants to go to the fire academy. He is hoping to move out and train as a career fireman. In terms of the case, suspects have been indicted, and now they're waiting for the court proceedings to move forward. But they are charged with aggravated sexual assault and attempted aggravated sexual assault.
Certainly one to watch in the year ahead. Nahid, thanks for joining us. Now joining us in the studio is Tasha Chaparis. Tasha, you covered the Chris Kyle trial amid all of the media buzz around the movie, and it was Oscar season. What was that like being part of that? I guess it was somewhat of a circus.
It was actually quite a media circus. You know, obviously there was a lot of local media. It was in Stephenville, which is a fairly small town southwest of Fort Worth. There was a lot of national media as well, focused on the trial. Obviously, the movie coming out, American Sniper, which was based on Chris Kyle's memoir, was coming out around that time. It was Oscar season. On a Sunday during the trial was the Oscars, and Taya Kyle, Chris Kyle's widow, actually attended the Oscars ceremony. There was a lot of question about whether she would do that because she was in court every day during that time period, but it gained a lot of attention. A lot of people were really interested in it. They had already have very strong feelings about Eddie Ray Routh, who at the time was accused of killing Chris Kyle and his friend Chad Littlefield at a gun range when the men were trying to help him in January 2013. And so it gained a lot of attention. There was a lot of focus on it. The town was basically under lockdown to some extent around the courthouse for quite a while around that period.
Kind of reminds me of Kaufman in 2013, just hearing about it. Sort of the same type of media feel.
Right.
Eddie Ray Routh, it was sort of a foregone conclusion that he was guilty. I mean, he pretty much...
Oh, he killed them. There was never any confusion about whether he had pulled the trigger and whether he had killed them. The big part of the trial was whether he was legally insane at the time of the crime. His defense attorneys were saying that he had myriad of mental health issues leading up to that incident, he'd originally said that he suffered from PTSD, and that is why Chris Kyle was working with him that day. But it came out during the trial that he didn't necessarily actually have PTSD. And the presumption was that if he were legally insane at that time, he would be in a mental institution for the rest of his life or get out sooner.
There were a lot of little details in the trial that I hadn't heard before, such as the exchange of text messages between them saying, you know, this guy's nuts.
Between Chad and Chris.
Right. Between the two victims here. What was sort of the reaction to hearing those kinds of details in this case?
It was very much a, okay, so this is basically a done deal. I think that was almost, you know, for lack of a better term, the nail in the coffin for Ralph at that point, hearing that these men were nervous about him and that he was acting erratically. However, the defense attorneys kind of used that as a, clearly he was acting out in a way that was suspicious and that showed that he might have been in an insane, you know, psychotic break in that point in time. But his behavior after the fact was really what was telling. He got takeout. He went to a fast food restaurant after he had stolen Chris Kyle's truck and was basically on the run. He went to his family's house and said, you know, I just committed murder. I committed capital murder. And that showed that he was aware of what he had done.
Well, thankfully, you don't have to drive to Stephenville anymore, but you did a great job covering it. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now joining us in the studio is Julie Fancher, who is a night reporter here. Julie, could you tell us a little bit about what you thought the biggest story in 2015 was that you covered?
For me, it was a tie, but probably both stories. They both happened in June of this year. The first one is a pretty horrific story about a then 14-year-old girl who was allegedly sexually assaulted by a family member of hers. And when other family members found out that she had been impregnated from that alleged sexual assault, they allegedly brutally beat her to induce an abortion.
So how far along was she around the time that happened?
She was 8 months pregnant.
So could you talk a little bit, I took part in this story too. We got the warrant late at night one night. We were writing that up. We went out to the neighborhood and talked to some of their neighbors. What was that like for you?
This whole story was incredibly sad and just horrific, and going to talk to these neighbors who knew this family, no one thought that they were capable of this. Everyone was just completely shocked. This was a well-liked family. They lived out in Pleasant Grove. Also good to note that this incident is alleged to have happened 2 years ago in 2013. The girl and a witness came forward in May of this year. So, you know, for 2 years, no one had reported this, and the family was just kind of living their life as normal until it was reported. So when we went out to the neighborhood talking to neighbors, they were just shocked by what they had heard. And just didn't really think it was possible for this family, who they said, you know, the kids were always clean, they were always fed, they had all these parties, they always had gatherings. It just didn't really fit. But
I remember the police, Deputy Chief Gil Garza, calling it a very tragic and very disturbing case. Now, you mentioned at the beginning that you had a tie. What was the other story?
The other story was the attack on Dallas Police Headquarters, which happened in the middle of the night on a Friday night. You were there with me, so I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, being out there all night.
Sure. We were in different places. You were, I believe, out at the standoff location, which was near Doughty Ferry Road. I went over to near headquarters where, as a police reporter, I go frequently, but I, you know, the road was blocked off, so I couldn't see much. But I was hearing a lot, and, you know, a source of mine texted me this picture of this van. I got a couple calls. The picture was the van, I believe, on some sort of private sales website, and it was terrifying. You could see the videos online. They were already circulating from people who were over at the hotel next door, showing that a gunman just absolutely unloaded. And the miraculous thing was that nobody was hurt. We heard a lot of reports early on that there was maybe more than one gunman. I'm sure from your location, it appeared to be the one guy.
Yeah.
And you know, I was a little bit skeptical when I kept hearing these other reports, but the one thing that kind of brought it home was the scale of this was when this 3 a.m. press conference, the police chief was saying, we found explosives in the parking lot and we're still looking for more. And they ended up finding, I believe, one other location where that had happened. But what was that like for you out at the other location?
It was pretty scary. I have honestly never felt that nervous driving out to a scene before, but we just didn't know what was going on. And it was really early on. I think I was one of the first reporters out in Hutchins where the standoff took place. And we were just kind of hanging out there because they had blocked off the whole highway, the area surrounding where the standoff was happening. But over the police radio, we kept hearing, you know, possible C-40, I mean, all these explosives. I mean, you could hear at one point, I think at like 5 a.m, they disabled the vehicle with a 50 millimeter gun.
It was a 50 caliber.
50 caliber, yeah. And so you're hearing gunshots and possible explosives.
I'm sure at some point you wondered if you were far enough away from the blast zone.
Yeah, I was asking someone around me, like, should we back up more? But I was kind of, I mean, even though I was in the middle of the action, I was kind of removed from all the updates. So I was kind of learning from you as you were at the press conference as what was going on, because I was just kind of watching the situation unfold. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about, I mean, you mentioned Chief Brown's 3 a.m. press conference, which is pretty unusual.
Yeah, I mean, it was just an unusual night. And I remember driving around and I at one point I parked over by City Hall just so I could type something up to send to our editor, and a cop actually tapped on my window, and, you know, he was like, I explained to him who I was, and he was like, oh, okay, well, I'm just being careful because it's a strange night, which made me laugh at the time, but it wasn't that funny, you know, because it really was that kind of tension in the air that early in the morning. And I think most people didn't really get to feel the full extent of that because they were asleep.
Right.
But there was real concern that this was just a kind of a widespread terrorist attack, that maybe there was some other explosive at other stations. Obviously, this is one that's not going to carry over into next year.
No,
suspect
it's not.
Is dead, but certainly a very memorable night for 2015.
Yep.
Our last reporter in today is Jen Emily. Jen, you hosted the podcast last week on Kids Are Criminals, but we felt like we left something on the table there. This was obviously a year for you of prison visits. What was that like for you interviewing all of these kids who had been committed crime as kids and are now in a grown up prison?
It was really interesting. I'd been to prison several times before to interview people, never, you know, as an inmate myself. And this time it was different because I knew I was interviewing people who were adults, but they had been locked up since they were anywhere from 11 to 16. And so you go thinking of them as children, as kids, and then you go to talk to them and they're adults. The people I talked to ranged in age from 17 to 58. And they all were in for things they did as kids. And you feel empathy for the kid, but you're wary of the adult. These people did heinous things. One of them killed a police officer. There were sex offenders there. A lot of them committed murder. And so you have to balance that with the fact that they were children.
How did that differ for you from interviewing people who had committed these crimes as adults? I mean, obviously, you know, murderer is not a murderer 24/7. They were a murderer for a moment in their life. Was it any different for you interviewing these people who had that moment in their life when they were very young?
It really was, because the focus of the stories were, what is it like to grow up in prison? What is it like to, you know, not have mom or dad or grandma or grandpa to raise you and teach you things, and instead you're in an environment where you're forbidden from touching. You don't get hugs. You don't learn how to get a job. You don't go to school. While you may get an education, you're not socializing. And it's a very different environment. So you're kind of wondering, what did they learn? What did they not learn? And it's a concern for when they get out that they're not going to have the skills necessary to adapt. It's very different if you get locked up at 11 or 14 than if you get locked up at 25 or 35.
You mentioned this, but I imagine it was it kind of jarring for you to see these people who you may have seen in images when they were kids, or you may even remember when they were kids, fully grown, sort of the, like when you see a kid in your family that you haven't seen for years, a nephew or a cousin, grown up. Obviously, this is a much different instance, and you didn't see them for a very good reason, and not just because they live far away.
It really was. Again, it's in that mindset. I would read about them for what they did when they were kids, and sometimes there would be a photo, or I would just imagine them as children, and then, they either sit down at the table across from you, or you interview them through the glass, and, they're adults. They're fully grown women and men, and they did this, in some cases, one bad thing. Sometimes it was many bad things, but it's just a balance of they did something bad. They committed a heinous crime, but again, it was one moment in their life.
So the juvenile justice issues have been around for a long time, not exclusively a 2015 thing, but obviously you brought a lot of attention to it. Do you foresee anything changing in the way that the state handles these juveniles in the future?
There's definitely going to be a change. It's already happening in places like Dallas County. You used to get certified to stand trial as an adult pretty easily, and now we're seeing instances where that doesn't happen. This year alone, there was a 14-year-old girl who drowned a baby, a tiny baby. She planned it out the night before and carried it out. And, almost certainly 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, she would have been standing trial as an adult. But instead, she's going through the juvenile system and then most likely will go on to be in the adult prison, just like a lot of these inmates that I talked to this year.
Well, we'll look forward to see if there's anything that does change on the state level. Jen, thank you for joining us. That's all for us today on the Texas Crimecast. Thank you for listening. Remember, you can catch our show every week on iTunes. You can also read all the stories you heard today and more on dallasnews.com. You can also like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast. Our producer and sound engineer today is Tommy Noel. For Tasha Shaparis, Julie Fancher, Naomi Martin, Nahid Rajwani, and Jen Emily, I'm Tristan Hallman. Stay safe out there.